This audio recording is of a Dublin Sheltercy meeting in UCD in February 2010, just a few days after fisherman Pat O'Donnell had been jailed. You'll find more information on Dublin Sheltercy at www.dublins2s.com.
So for those of you who are very familiar with, my apologies, I just wanted to sketch in some of the background for people maybe who are not. Oil was first discovered in the Corrib field in 1996 by a company called Enterprise Oil. Shell purchased that company in 2002. Shell had the biggest stake in the field, it has 45%. Statoil, which is largely owned by the Norwegian state, has 36.5%, and the remaining chunk is held by a Canadian company, Vermilion. And the plan was always, on Shell's consortium's part, to extract the gas, pipe it through Broadhaven Bay, which is an area of astonishing natural beauty, to a landfall site in Glengad, where the pipeline would come ashore, and from there pipe it onwards in a still, raw and unstable state, over 9 kilometres of unstable bog land, to a refinery in Ballinboy, which is 9 kilometres inland. The gas was expected to flow by the year 2003, so they're already 7 years behind schedule in that regard. But local people objected very strongly to both the routing of the high-pressure pipeline and to the site of the refinery. In 2002, as far back as 2002, an original Bord Pleanála hearing on the project deemed that the site, the refinery site, the end point, the terminus for this 9 kilometre onshore pipeline was, as the planning inspector put it, senior planning officer put it at the time, the wrong site. So from a strategic planning perspective, it's the wrong site. From the perspective of government policy, it's the wrong site. Environmental impact, it's the wrong site. And the preferred alternative option for most local people was that the gas be refined onshore, offshore, I beg your pardon, and hence the campaign slogan Shell Sea, which is where that came from. I'm not going to go the origin of that. I think that's a very vital point, because most protesters from the outset have not been opposed to the extraction of the gas. They've been opposed to the method by which Shell and his partners have chosen or have proposed to extract the gas. After that original rejection of the refinery site by Bord Pleanála, Shell met with Bertie Ahern and met with other senior politicians later in 2003 and encouraged them to reapply for planning permission. They did so, and the original decision was overturned in 2004. Then in the Boy, the original site for the refinery is given the go-ahead, and the refinery is almost complete there now. And then before the onshore pipeline had actually been given planning permission, Shell sought to enter local people's land to mark out the pipeline route. People protested, they refused to give permission, but the state had already weighed in behind Shell on this. They had issued compulsory purchase orders against local farmers, and people's refusal to promise that they would not interfere with the construction of the pipeline led to 5 local men being held in contempt of court and the jailing of the so-called Rossport 5. In 2005, they spent 94 days in jail. Their concerns, as with other people in the area, are fundamentally around the potentially cataclysmic effects of a major pipeline explosion. And at the oral hearings into a modified onshore pipeline route, this is a slight modification of the original onshore pipeline route, at oral hearings last year at Bord Pleanála held, the representatives of the consortium, Shell and its partners, were obliged to conceive that it's a unique pipeline of a type found nowhere else in the world. Safety concerns cannot be allayed on the basis of precedents elsewhere. Shell consultants also conceded at that on Bord Pleanála hearing last summer that houses, in the event of a gas leak, houses within 230 metres of the pipeline could burn spontaneously from heat radiation. A lot of other problems with the project. The project has been characterised by repeated, persistent breaches of environmental law by the consortium representatives. It's also even more alarmingly associated with persistent breaches of human rights law. There's been routine and systematic abuse of local protesters' human rights by the Gardaí and by private security forces employed by the companies. protesters have repeatedly beaten and harassed, they've been prosecuted with trumped up charges, confirmed by bodies like the US human rights NGO Global Community Monitor, and human rights monitoring that AFRI was engaged in last summer, as recently as last summer, confirmed that you've still got a lot of guard abuses, intimidation, harassment, assault of protesters' human rights. And yet, of course, ironically, it's protesters who are routinely prosecuted and jailed for such offences. Patrick will be the most recent in that regard. Another development late last year was the Garda Ombudsman Commission accepted that a significant number of complaints that local people had made against the Gardaí were legitimate and credible and were to be investigated. And indeed, disciplinary action against one senior Garda officer has been recommended by the Garda Ombudsman Commission for one particular incident of very aggressive policing, but that has not been acted upon by the Garda Commission. The other major human rights concern concerns the activities of the private security force integrated risk management system employed by Shell. They've been engaged in, again, intimidation and harassment of peaceful protesters. It was they who beat up Willie Cardiff, one of the Roscoe 5, who last year was very badly beaten by security guards inside the compound at Glendale at the landfall site. They would also be the prime suspects in the sinking by four armed and masked men of Pat O'Donnell's boat last year as well. Michael Dwyer, the unfortunate Irishman who was killed by the security forces last year, was previously an employee of IMRS, and he was put in touch with the right-wing mercenary networks who he ended up dying with, or serving with, and dying amongst two, some people died in Bolivia during his time working as a Shell security guard. One of the people who was called as a witness against Pat O'Donnell, was one of the other protesters, was a Hungarian who was wanted by the Bolivian authorities for his participation in the attempted coup in Bolivia. So, for a variety of reasons, including economic reasons, you know, it's often said that, well, the project has to go ahead because it's vital for national energy security. In fact, it's not, as Quina will discuss. There's very little, for the Irish economy from this project, from the wider Irish economy. Despite that, people outside the area perceive this, and they've often perceived this, as ignorant Luddites trying to obstruct vital progress. And that's helped out by the intensive media campaign of vilification of protesters, of which the most egregious example is the outrageous Paul Williams documentary, which TV3 helpfully repeated last week. Vincent Brown was supposed to be getting a right of reply to protesters on that issue, but decided against it. I'll leave it at that, just in terms of hopefully that provides something by way of background. In the light of all of the above factors, the human rights issues, the environmental issues, the health and safety issues, the economic issues that we'll talk about, AFRI is calling on the Irish government to suspend the project and argue that it should only be allowed to resume if local people are not forced to live, at a very minimum, with a high-pressure pipeline carrying unrefined gas through their community. The gas, if it is to be refined at all, and there's a strong case in theory of global warming that we shouldn't be burning any more fossil fuels at all, but if it is to be refined at all, then it should be refined offshore or at a location acceptable to the local community. That is a minimum demand that I think is an eminently reasonable demand.
Okay. Thank you, Vickers, and the spokesperson for the Dublin Shell to see. Do you want me to sign up or am I okay, sir? Basically, Maura was going to do the introduction to Shell to see who the campaign is, but seeing as she's running late, I'm going to just do a very brief one. There's a lot of faces here I don't know, which is very positive. But basically, who Shell to see are a national campaign, and all the different areas basically around the country have their own branches. So Dublin Shell to see are hosting this tonight. There's a Mayo Shell to see, obviously, with the Rossport Solidarity Camp, who are also based in Aberystwyth and Mayo. Galway Shell to see, Sligo Shell to see, Waterford Shell to see, Belfast Shell to see, Cork Shell to see, and probably many others. I can't remember off the top of my head, but we recently got a Gort one as well, set up, and one in Kildare as well. So we actually, in the last year, we've had a kind of smaller one starting to spring up around the country, which presumably is kind of in relation to the recession and people becoming aware of natural resources and the war to them and basically the situation we're in at the moment. Shell to Sea, who's involved in it and what is the campaign? The words Shell to Sea were kind of applied to the campaign about 5 years ago in 2005. The campaign as a whole against the Corrib Gas Project in Mayo has been going for about 15 or 16 years now. Basically, at first locals tried to use the state means and all of the different administrative means and going through the different processes of the state to try and get this project stopped and to get some attention paid to the very legitimate health and safety concerns to do with the project. When they realised that wasn't working and when they realised that they were basically being ignored at all the different funds that they went to, and when they realised there was a very real threat that six local people were going to go to prison, basically they started promoting this at a more national level and started asking for the people of Ireland to start getting involved. I myself first came involved in Mayo in June 2005, I think, when there was a gathering, local people organised a gathering for people to come from all over the country and stay for the June Bank Holiday weekend. I personally had only heard about it at about midnight the night before in the pub with some friends who were going down, and that's how I ended up getting involved in Shell to Sea. I hopped on a bus the next morning. So basically, that was just before the Rossport 5% prison. Interestingly enough, and it's quite interesting, particularly now, originally there was actually a Rossport 6. We had 5 men and 1 woman landowners along the route, and Shell decided to drop all their legal charges against the woman because they felt it would be bad PR. And that's quite relevant because still today we have extremely selective processing of different activists based on what Shell perceives to be good PR for itself. So, for example, Pat O'Donnell, the fisherman who's in prison at the moment, is someone who was very heavily involved in the last year in trying to stop Shell at sea with his boats. He is now serving a prison sentence. Maura Harrington and Terence Conway, who are both the spokespeople for Mayo Shell to Sea, have been harassed by the Gardaí repeatedly down there, are constantly up on charges, with Maura having served 4 different prison sentences at this stage and looking at serving more in the future as well. So from the very start, we've had an extremely selective application of who's brought through the courts and who isn't on the basis of what Shell feels is useful for it as opposed to the application of law in a proper way in the area. What I'm going to focus on mostly is the natural resources. I don't know how much people know about the natural resources. Generally, in these meetings, you kind of have a few people who know loads about it and a few people who know nothing about it. So I'm going to kind of try and start at the start and go through it relatively slowly. According to the Department of Community, Energy and Natural Resources, of which Eamon Ryan is the minister, there's 10 billion barrels of oil equivalent off the west coast of Ireland. 10 billion barrels of oil equivalent is quite an enormous amount of oil and gas. Basically, when the industry and internationally, the way they measure oil and gas is they basically combine the two into what's called oil equivalent. So they don't, when they're trying to measure big, large areas, they just combine the two and call it oil equivalent. So we have, according to our government, 10 billion barrels of oil equivalent off the west coast of Ireland. At the moment, today, that's worth 560 billion euros, which when you take our recession and the current state of our economic climate and how many millions this country is borrowing on a daily basis just to keep itself ticking over, never mind even the cutbacks that we're all being faced with and that we're all feeling at the moment, 560 billion euro is absolutely enormous amounts of money. The figure that is in the Sunday Independent and in the leaflets is 420 billion. That's because the research that was compiled and when we compiled it all, we finished it all and signed off on it last September. And at the time, the barrel of oil was average stage over 2009, but that stage has been $60 to the barrel of oil, which is $420 billion at the moment, at that time, 420 billion euros at that time. Today, the barrel of oil is at $77, and with today's currency exchange rates, that actually equals 560 million. So from September to here, our oil and gas has gone from 420 billion to 560 billion in just that short space of time. That figure only applies to the west coast of Ireland. It doesn't apply to the south, where there have been oil and gas finds before, and it doesn't apply to inland. So places like Loch Allen has a massive gas find under it, which alone is 9 times the size of the current gas field. It's 9 trillion cubic feet of gas. So that figure, while it's getting, the worth is getting higher every day as oil will, you know, generally goes up, it's only relating to the west coast of Ireland. Now, we would call, what's the term that's been used to describe this state at the moment is the way it is, it's the great oil and gas giveaway. Because as it stands, that those hundreds of billions of euro worth of oil and gas that we have, we would stand to own nothing of it. Basically, what happens is an oil and gas company will come in and stay in the case of Carrib, Shell, Statoil, are the main stakeholders in it. But an oil and gas company will come in, they'll get a license, they buy it for extremely cheap, we're talking thousands of euro. They are then given the rights to go and explore that area. Now, the government has already provided the funding for most of those areas to be explored already. We already know where roughly there's oil and gas. We already know roughly where there's huge amounts of oil and gas. So they come in and buy the licences. Whatever they find, they now own 100% of. So the Irish government gives them the right to look for it, and when they find it, they own all of it. We get no royalties off it, which would be normal practice around the world, where the state would retain a certain percentage of ownership of any fines. We have zero. We have absolutely no royalties. And what we have is a tax on it, a 25% tax. For your average field, to a 25% tax, and that all costs can be deducted against that. So you often hear Shell whinging on the television about how much this costs and how much the delays have cost, and they're paying all this extra for security, they're paying all this extra. In reality, they're not really, because it's all deducted against costs. It's all deducted off their tax bills anyway. So all costs, all putting up the refineries, putting in gas pipes, or oil pipes, they're putting in all of that, all of the construction costs, wages, the whole lot is deducted then from tax. So the amount of tax we actually do get in at that 25% is quite low. On top of that, we're getting a lot of the time, particularly Shell and the government's line around Carrib is, yeah, but Ireland has no security of supply. We're dependent on our oil and gas at the moment coming through Russia and Eastern Europe, and because Russia and places like the Ukraine are constantly having to tit-for-tat with each other over the oil and gas and shutting each other's pipelines off, we're in quite a precarious situation. In actual fact, our oil and gas, yes, some of it does come from there. Some comes from Norway, in which there's no threats around it. Some actually comes from Asia. So in terms of our security supply, as it stands at the moment, so far we've had no threats. This is the first point. And the second point is, there is absolutely nothing written anywhere in any of the agreements that any of our oil and gas that's found would have to be pumped into our system. There's absolutely no agreement on that anywhere, and there's no guarantees of it. At the moment, as it stands, with 3 interconnector pipes going from Ireland to the UK, and they are more than welcome to export all of their oil and gas out of the country that they find. Bearing in mind that Shell is Royal Dutch Shell, there's a very large chance that they are going to start exporting stuff to the UK. If they do decide to sell it to us, which you would kind of presume they're going, they probably will do, because you would presume that that's what's most convenient to them, that they pipe it into the Bord Gáis networks, we will have to buy it back at full market price. So not only will we get no royalties off it, not only will we get a very, very low tax intake from it, we'll have to pay for it at full market price. We will have to bid against the UK, we'll have to bid against Europe, we'll have to bid against all the rest of the countries in the world for the oil and gas that we originally gave to them for nothing. So that's at a very basic where the oil and gas situation stands. The government's basic line on it is that, one, it's incredibly difficult to find oil and gas off the west coast of Ireland. It's complete and utter rubbish. It was very difficult to find oil and gas off the west coast of Ireland. And when they use statistics, they often say, oh, well, if you go out into the Atlantic Ocean, you have a 32-to-1 chance of finding oil and gas. You did have a 32-to-1 chance of finding oil and gas. But with recent developments in technology, the difficulty in finding oil and gas, particularly in deep waters, has gone way down. For an example, 3 years ago, when you would have seen a lot of the protests around Carrib on the television, where the people being dragged around the place, Shell's big line at that time was, we can't find the gas at sea because the wellhead is so deep, it's 4,000 metres. That would be, is it 4,000 metres? Yeah, it's basically their line at the time was that it was very, very deep water. And at the time, it actually was quite deep water. They could still find it at sea. They would find deeper wellheads at sea. But now, Para would be considered not at all deep. And that's in the space of 3 years. Their technologies and what they can do in deep waters and in difficult waters are increasing all the time. And the idea that it's difficult now to find oil and gas off the west coast of Ireland, when the government itself is admitting openly that there's 10 billion barrels of oil and gas out there, is absolutely ludicrous. They also compare us to all these different other countries. You'll often hear them mention Portugal and France and whatever other random European country they can think off the top of their head when on the radio. This is basically the average take for any oil-producing company is 68%. That would be the average internationally. And as it stands at the moment, the only country in the world that gets less from its oil and gas reserves than Ireland is Cameroon. Nigeria, most African countries, all of the Latin American countries, all of them are getting more. So most third world countries are getting much more off their oil and gas and have been able to argue a broker with the oil and gas companies around that. Just one other thing to say in it. Another big argument is, the deal's done, what can we do? As it stands at the moment, the minister can openly renegotiate the deal and demand that any deals that are currently done are renegotiated on the basis of if the oil company or the gas company is found to have broken procedures around a number of areas, one of which is environmental. So, I mean, down in Mayo, Shell has blatantly flaunted both Irish state and European environmental legislation. It would be very, very easy for the government to go back to the drawing board in terms of economically renegotiating these deals. And the other thing they say is, oh, there'd be international outcry. Nobody would want to do business with Ireland. Number one, any oil and gas company would be extremely happy to come here. Even the slightest of changes within our current setup around the resources. And the other thing is, countries like Venezuela, Bolivia, Russia have all renegotiated their oil and gas in the last few years. And in each case, the oil and gas companies threw massive hissy fits, and the EU and the US threw massive hissy fits, and said, you can't do this. All the oil and gas companies will leave, and you won't have the expertise to do it yourself. In the end, they said, they accepted the new terms. They were getting a lot less profit, but they were still getting profit, and the people within those countries, the people living within those countries now are getting a lot of the benefit of the work of their natural resources, obviously going into their public services systems. I'm going to leave it at that. If anyone has any questions on it, please ask, because I know myself it took a bit of time to get my head around all of it when I first started looking into it, and it's quite complex. But similarly, if there's anyone who has more detailed questions, want me to go into more detail on anything, please feel free to ask. And just to say, the Sunday Independent leaflets that you have, that most people have on their chairs, so some up here if people don't want them, have the figures of the oil and gas in it as well. And they have a bit of an explanation as to €420 billion, what that would actually equate to. This here, the 420 billion giveaway document, is something that we've done up for politicians, for stakeholders and for media outlets, and it actually has quite a bit of a campaign in large detail and with a large amount of references in it as well. So if anybody wants the more in-depth one, please feel free to take a copy of that as well later on.
Great. Have copies of the contracts?
No, not here.
No, but I mean, just because you're saying that, you're talking about the contracts and what's in them, and it would be an interesting position to look at the possibility of compelling the government to renegotiate the contracts, and I think that possible argument could be put forward that as Irish citizens were beneficiaries, the government or the state held those resources in trust for us, and therefore we could assert a claim for renegotiation on that basis. But if you have copies of all the contracts, that would be helpful.
Would you say the contracts are based on the fiscal terms? So you have 1982 and 2007 license and fiscal terms, which document the terms of the state, and the contracts are based upon those. So those are freely available. You can find them on the Public Affairs Division website as well. But you're right also to point about long state leaves our constitution, there's a clause that the natural resources of Ireland belong to the people of Ireland. So we have this early arrangement statement. Does anyone want to ask? Well, we have a brief question and answer session in the meantime while we're waiting for Maura. So what we'll do is take a couple of questions and we'll come back then to our speakers and just do that order. So anybody would like to ask some questions or some comments?
How has the Department of Natural Resources responded to, your campaign and things like that and questions and this whole thing?
In quite all over the place way is the honest answer. A lot of lip service and a lot of yes, we're very concerned. When Noel Dempsey was in, obviously, it was very different. It was like, yeah, whatever, was the kind of attitude we got. With the Greens coming in and Aidan Ryan taking over, it's been a lot of lip service, a lot of I'm very concerned, tell me. And he has come down and met people from the local community, and he has made time for people to meet him in Dublin as well. He'll nod a lot, but in reality, he's not changing anything. He's done bizarre things, like they put a fund where they're now funding, is it, how many millions are they putting into Arizona? Can you remember?
I can't remember.
A few months ago, they announced they were putting in, it's up to 7 million, I can't remember exactly how much, into Eris, into the local area in Mayo, to put footpaths in and signposts, nice areas and stuff. So you get really bizarre governmental responses like that. I mean, this has never been about money for anybody in the local area, ever. And there's this kind of like pat on the head approach, oh, we put footpaths in, so you're banned there, don't worry about the big refinery that's going over there and it might explode, just don't stress about it.
So they feel they've made agreements then that they can't go back on. Is that what it is, and then they're following off with the rest?
Pretty much. He knows he can go back on the agreements. He just has chosen not to. And what he's doing is trying to give the impression that he can't go back on them, when in actual fact he could if he wanted to. Basically, there's an extreme reluctance in the government to take on the oil and gas companies. Why they've done this is probably related back to the fact that years ago we did get, in the 70s and stuff, we did get royalties on our oil and gas mines, and Ray Burke met with oil and gas companies behind closed doors by himself against the advice of the senior civil servants, and after those meetings basically started eroding away all our royalties and putting them down to zero. So I would imagine the reluctance of the government to tackle the oil and gas probably comes from the fact that a lot of the people who are now head honchos within Fianna Fáil, or who have been, and people like Bertie and stuff, were heavily involved in stripping away all our oil and gas rights years ago, and it's probably not something they want anybody delving into too much. That's my presumption.
I'm just wondering, is there an issue of where this gas could be ending up? Because it was within the last year that some of the fishermen spotted either a British Navy boat, or it was either that or they were submarines. But in any case, I lived there until recently, and my house was for rent, and I got an interesting phone call one day, and it was from the British police looking to rent my house, because my wife had worked in London in the civil service there, and she recognised the number, and as far as she could make out, it was the same number as MI5, so that's another element of it, where exactly is this, where is this gas meant for, and why are the apparently the British government taking such an interest in it? Just put that out there.
Do you want me to come up with
that? Maybe take a few.
Okay, great. Sorry, Niamh, and then
just a short question, and I'm new to the campaign, but is there any political party or politician that has taken on the campaign or has supported it? Have you posed any parliamentary questions? Is there any way of gaining any kind of political will? Just in general.
Why do you think the media being so crucial? And has there been any journalists being sympathetic at all to the campaign?
I'll take one more question and we'll come back to
legal efforts. arguing what's stated here. I'm just wondering what legal efforts are there any legal teams on the Shetland Sea side arguing what the pension plan is?
Around the management of natural resources? Or
around the contracts that were written and having the ability to rescind or rewrite contracts.
Okay, thank you. We'll come back to us.
I'm not sure about external involvement. I mean, I think the most sinister external actors are definitely the IMRS, the American Mercenary Networks, who are you know, obviously documented involvement with far right groups in Eastern Europe and Latin America. Their involvement, especially the presumed involvement in the sinking of Pandora's gold, which I think that's a very, very sinister external dimension. Two of the politicians who were probably most associated with the on the progressive side were local politician Terry Crowley, TD, who lost the seat in the last general election, and Joe Higgins, MEP, but also lost the seat. But of course, the party, and Sinn Féin, hasn't done a lot on the issue, but is supportive of the campaign. But of course, the people who were most high profile associated with it were John Gormley and Eamon Ryan, and the Green Party generally. When not in office, a lot of posters or pictures of them, which holding out posters, they were there at the release of the Rossport Five from jail and so on. So we'll come back to that one. The media lie, I think there's been a deliberate attempt by the Shell to cultivate the media. They realised they made a PR disaster in 2005 by jailing the Rossport Five. They've since gone out of the way to burnish their image. A lot of local journalists have been hired. Their head in Ireland is John Egan, who's an Irishman, who was formerly a BBC correspondent. He was actually a BBC correspondent who covered the Ken Saro-Wiwa trial in Nigeria, and he now works for Shell. And a lot of other, they've gone out of their way to cultivate media sources. I mentioned Paul Williams' TV3 documentary, which is a great vilification of the campaign. But Williams was the first rugby match played at Croke Park was Ireland versus England. Paul Williams was a guest in the Shell corporate box. So they do go out in a way to cultivate the media. And then when you do have good media people, like for example Lawrence Higgins in the Irish Times, but it's very fair in their reporting, trying to cover the issue very, very well. But very, very few and far between, for the most part, especially in recent years where it's become very much the daily week of crime correspondents, who are very close to the Gardaí, people like Williams, and that has created another dynamic. In terms of, there's a lot of legal efforts going on. There's, for example, different people are exploring the possibility of applying for a judicial review if on board Canola were to grant permission for the review pipeline, because there are the fact that Eamon Ryan's Department for Energy has tried to influence on board Canola, has written to on board Canola protesting its initial finding on the modified pipeline route that could create grounds for judicial review if they were to reverse that decision. So there is a lot of legal work on that. Maybe more than that.
Yeah, I mean, in relation to the institutional question as well, the political parties, basically anyone who's not very right wing in Ireland has been heavily supportive of the Shell to Sea campaign over the years. Particularly when the Rossport Five were in prison. I mean, you had all of them, Labour, the Greens, Sinn Féin, Socialist Party, Socialist Workers Party, IRE, the WSM, the Irish Solidarity Movement, and various other different parties. So yes, is the answer to that. There's been lots of different political parties that have lent support over the years, or who are very heavily involved still today. And you have, in terms of parliamentary questions, we've asked loads, but really all they do is kind of highlight the issue of fishing and the Dáil record. Doesn't really do much else other than that for us, or things like finding out exactly how much the policing has cost and stuff. You know, those kind of issues are useful for us to ask parliamentary questions on, but it hasn't been something that's been of massive use to us in the past. In relation to the media being so bad, this is something that I personally have dealt with a lot, being a spokesperson. Basically, one of the large problems was Tony O'Reilly. Tony O'Reilly has the license for a massive oil and gas field off the west coast of Ireland. It's huge. It's absolutely huge. And he owns independent newspapers, which I did open very recently. And he basically controls all of the Irish Independent, Sunday Independent, Metro Herald now, the Evening Herald, and so on and so on. Most of the tabloids, he owns the vast majority of the media, so he obviously is not pro any campaign that is talking about shooting his profits in his oil and gas fields. So that's part of the reason. There are decent people within the media who try to cover it fairly. They generally find it quite hard to get past their editors. Shell also, one of the tactics they started using was they take, you know, you'll see every once in a while this massive full page ad in the broadsheets for Corrib Gas, Fuel for Life, which is quite funny. But basically, what they do is they put huge pressure on the editors by throwing enormous amounts of money at advertising towards so much kills two birds with one stone for them. So that's basically where that is. And in terms of the legal stuff, yes, there are people looking into the judicial reviews and all that, not specifically going into the contracts around the oil and gas stuff. And a large reason for that is it's so incredibly expensive. I mean, last week alone, we had 30 different local people up on ridiculous charges down in Mayo last week. All these minor public order offences, and what they basically do is tie us up in courts and tie us up in having to pay legal fees. And they're doing things like refusing people who are on the dole and trying to pay mortgages, they're refusing them legal aid and stuff. So you've all this, like, basically trying to cut off any access to legal routes at all for people. It's very difficult, you know, taking on the big cases like that are just so cost consuming.
Yeah, but I mean, you can be creative in your approach. And I just saw my way in here. I noticed posters up for Cecil Avery moot court competition, and he was my grandfather. He died 20 years or so or more ago, and he was quite significant in terms of judgments. He passed down as Supreme Court judge, and property rights was the Southern Industrial Trust was the most significant case. Well, it's the one that sort of everybody associates with him. I don't know if there's any other lawyers here, but I was previously involved with the Dunmurry Crisis Centre and ran a law competition there. And you know, you could. Shelter Seek could run a competition for law students or trainee barristers on the issues to do with contract to do with contract law, and you know you get good sharp minds applying themselves to the problems
Just quite some more questions. So you join.
I just wanted to ask, you were saying about, you know, former politicians having, I suppose, relinquished our rights to the royalties, and just what was to be gained in them doing that, and what you think the reason for that was, because obviously then, you know, the profits aren't being brought back within the Irish Exchequer, so what was their reason for doing that?
Okay,
it's the population down the Mayo is devoided, or is it like, you know, what ways the local reaction.
I just didn't know the sort of hatchet job documentary where he accused all sorts of people behind it, and what a special match for that in there. They've just bad as I remember.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, sir.
Sorry, just wondering how much has been extracted already lately? And then this is just a much broader question maybe for later on. How do we go about nationalising? I know in a lot of your literature says to nationalise. I'm wondering how you think that's possible.
Okay, thank you. We'll take your question and then we'll clarify.
Just as far as I'm aware, within the last year or so, Ireland applied to the United Nations to receive, to add more territory out in the Atlantic Ocean to the state. And I was just wondering, like, as soon as I heard it, Shell popped into mind. Like, I thought that was that the primary motivation behind it?
Great. Back to
the obviously, well, you know, while we're doing work, we behind closed doors, without any of the civil servants present. Not rocket science. I think in other cases, it's, you know, so the 7th decision, I think it probably is coming to that, there's no other valid explanation. In other cases, there is a kind of an ideological commitment to a pro-corporate stance. You know, there are certain people who are true believers in the market. I actually believe that, you know, the route to prosperity is by enriching cooperation, but that trickles down to the economy as a whole. So I think it's a mixture, but and then in some cases, I think it's perhaps a degree of political cowardice of not wanting to take on a very difficult and very challenging issue. And I think that's true to some people now. Is the population divided? Within the local area, I would say no, I don't think. In the sense that everybody in the immediate affected area is opposed to the pipeline. There are divisions in the sense that some people continue to favour the original Chelsea position, the offshore refinery. A lot of local people are willing to accept a compromise proposal where there will be a refinery onshore, but right on the shore. So there will be no onshore pipeline, piping unstable gas. But there is complete unity in the local area around the absolute non-desirability of a pipeline transporting raw gas. There is, in the broader Mayo area, people who are outside that immediately affected area, there is some support in terms of, you know, groups that have been cultivated by Shell to some extent, but also groups who perceive it as, you know, bringing jobs and so on to the area. But in the immediate area, I think it's quite unified. How much has been extracted today? Nothing. Nothing. From the car? Nothing at all.
I mean, a very general natural resources by private companies.
Yeah, there's been some. I mean, since the what was the 70s one? The
Consider,
yeah. I mean, I don't know what the actual figure is, but there has been some. An interesting historical artifact around the Kinsale gas find was that when Kinsale gas came ashore, that led to the renegotiation of terms by Justin Keating, who was the Labour Minister for Energy in the 1970s, who instituted terms that were actually more favourable for the companies to encourage further exploration. And at the time, obviously, as I said, out of Irish Natural Resources, of course, those terms are now looked back on as a golden age in terms of what could have been achieved. But I'm not sure of the exact figure, certainly nothing from Carter, or nothing from the 10 billion, the figure of the 10 billion barrels equivalent that people mentioned. How to nationalise? Well, I don't know, not everybody is necessarily recommending nationalisation. I mean, it can be done. And it has been done in other jurisdictions. There's certainly not the, we have mentioned the power of the Minister for Marine and Natural Resources to abrogate an agreement on if environmental breaches have occurred, and they have certainly occurred, routinely occurred. So that's one legal avenue. You could simply cancel the existing contract and renegotiate a new contract. Whether that involved 10 or 20 or 50% stake on the part of the state, or whether it involves complete nationalisation, that would be, you know, let's pray for the day that we get to have that debate and as to what exactly the way it should be. And I'm sure the application to the UN for the extension of Irish waters is I'm sure it's related to that.
Yeah,
I'm not going to say any more, but the reason we went great work was signing away a lot of our stuff, but not seeing the reason considering what is since we found out it should be that. But I think, yes, I think Andy's kind of covered that. The locals being divided, no, not really. There are people in the area who are pro the project. There's no point in saying there's not. There are people in the area that are pro the project. The numbers of them are very small, and they tend to be local business people who've got huge grants off Shell, or who are going to benefit very directly from Shell giving huge grants to other people locally. You know, in terms of their businesses being boosted, they tend to be, like you see one, this pro Mayo gas group, which is headed up by an ex Fianna Fáil councillor, who seems to be the only person that's in it, to be very honest. It's the only person you ever hear talking from, certainly. There are some big business people in the area who are pro the project, but the numbers are very small, and certainly in terms of people, like Andy was saying, very locally, no. It's not divided. Different opinions, of course, on how things should proceed, but that's natural everywhere. In relation to special branch questions, sometimes there's big protests around, you get special branch down, and they tend to show up at all protests, really, I think, have a gawk around. They can be quite harassing of people at times, but that's the local Gardaí, to be honest, on a day-to-day basis, are far worse. Their attitudes towards local people are horrendous, and we've been told in no uncertain terms from experience that no matter what Shell or Shell staff do, that it will be completely ignored, and that what
anything that we do, so much as sneeze, we're going to be arrested for a public order offence. So, I mean, in terms of justice, I was down in Mayo over the summer when they were laying the pipe. I was down for a weekend, and there was in a bay that's normally very quite tranquil, it's a very beautiful rural place. There was 18 different boats, you know, two Irish Navy boats, loads of Garda rig boats, loads of IRMS, the Shell private security firm, out in it, and then the pipeline boat every so often on out in the kayak. But I mean, and there was days where you had those 18 boats out, you had Air Force planes flying overhead, and you had Gardaí and you had the riot guards down in hundreds. I mean, the area was very militarised all to get this pipe bunch. I mean, that's an enormous cost to the Irish taxpayer. In the summer of 2009, when they were looking at, they just brought in that emergency budget late, but it was just so ludicrous. So, I mean, that's kind of the, I guess, the policing down there. Yeah, much attracted already. Out of that 10 million barrels of oil equivalent, it's all still there, and you can actually see it on the maps. Those orange, the yellow areas, the pale yellow areas are two basins. That big, wide one that's coming down is the Rockall basin that's coming up from Donegal and down, and then you have lower down, that kind of little blobby one, is the Porcupine Basin. All the bits that are blue, those blue boxes, are places that are already, the oil companies already have ownership of. They have the licenses for those areas, and they can be exploring them now. That little red box is Kinsale down under the south. That's what's already been taken out of Irish waters. But that's pretty well, that's almost gone now. So that's kind of how that stands at the moment. And in relation then, just to take that a step further, to the Atlantic stuff, the Atlantic rezoning, yeah, I mean, you would imagine that's going to have a huge impact for oil and gas. They've realised when you go into the deeper waters of the Atlantic, that that our rock systems, basically our geology, is very similar to off the coast of Canada, and actually the Irish and the Canadians are now going to be teaming up to do a lot of cross research sharing about that. So the Irish government are basically, well, they're very excited, the oil and gas companies are very excited about the fact that it's such similar geology, because Canada, in their part of it, had found enormous oil and gas reserves. So it looks like they don't know for definitely yet, but it looks like there's enormous amounts more out there. That's what they're expecting anyway. And how we go about nationalising, for a start, getting more people involved in the campaign, because it's not going to happen just because we wanted to. There's a lot of work to be done in it, and certainly a lot of pressure. I mean, we're going to have to apply enormous amounts of pressure. There's been a hell of, this is obviously, most people have heard of Shell CEO or the Corrib Gas project at this stage. I mean, the pressure very much has to be applied on before we can get that on the agenda in the first place. And I mean, there are many, many different models internationally as to how different countries have nationalised without the backing, obviously, of the oil and gas company. So there are many different models of that around the place. And people, there are also models of people who didn't nationalise fully, but who would have taken back 80% or 90%. So all those models exist internationally. Yeah.
And just on that, actually, to add to what you said, around 77% of all the oil reserves in the world are held by national oil companies. So in the 70s and 80s in Ireland, we kind of, our terms, obviously there was a corruption, there was dirty deals that went on, but it mirrored a global trend to open up licensing around free markets. So it was around making it more attractive to companies. Companies weren't asking for so much returns, but nowhere had dropped the level that Ireland had done. And since then, particularly around the mid-90s, Up to now, a lot of countries have renationalised or have radically improved their terms. So I said, the Ireland roughly take, if you count the tax rate, which companies can offset the cost against, it's only 25%. The lowest terms nearest that, aside from Cameroon, is 40%. You know, you have other countries that are looking at 90%. So when it comes to the returns, some countries are renationalising, but some are also looking for really significant take back, and take it from loyalty, profits, taxes, that sort of thing. And also too, when it comes to just the licensing, there's only three petroleum leases outstanding in Ireland at the moment, which is Corrib, Kinsale by Cotton, and Seven Heads. So that's the only exploration that can happen, or sorry, commercial production The other areas, Cuba's highlighted the blue areas, they're all exploring. But when the companies are exploring, they have to apply for a petroleum lease and reapply for to actually commercial mine. So in that application for the petroleum lease, I believe there's potential there for renegotiation of terms as well when it comes down to how the fiscal return and stuff. Sorry for that. Okay, any more questions? Yeah.
I just wondered if you're aware of the terms in relation to the deal whereby Shell acquired the Culture land on which the refinery is built.
The Culture? Okay.
I wonder if I missed out on your answer to Neil's question about where this registers across the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. In other words, what's the position of the opposition, in particular the party which has a strong representation for Mayo in it and which is deemed to be the next kind of ruling party. So where, and Labour Party, etc. What is their position on this issue? Or have they a position?
Okay, that's good.
Just wondering about the international boundary line. Is it 200 miles off your coast? Are your coastal waters? And secondly, I'm wondering who the key kind of power players are in the government. I mean, obviously there was the Taoiseach and Eamon Ryan, but I mean, I heard Eamon O'Quay was on the radio there recently as well, and George Hook. And so I'm wondering who are the people that you put pressure on that are in government.
Okay,
cool.
This is a comment more than anything. And I fully support your campaign. But when I tell people about it, nobody believes it. And I think about girls said, but why? We all know why Ray Burke did it, okay, it was behind closed doors. But is there any way of unearthing exactly what happened and having really strong evidence to convince people that this was the cause of the sellout? Because, to be honest, I think people think it's such an unbelievable story.
My question then really was why we were such a different example to others. Obviously, if it was dodgy dealings, fair enough. If it is, it's pretty that. But if we are, you know, on a par or even lower still and somewhere like Cameroon, why weren't they looking maybe at the European model and trying to emulate that? Why were we so extreme in comparison? And why is Charlie Hoagie's name being left out of it? Because I have it on good authority that he was involved in some negotiation, but he seems to have sort of escaped any of those.
Okay, let me come back to these questions. Yeah, sure. In relation to Quilche, as far as I know, local people had tried really hard to find that out and to find out if Shell Refinery is built in what was Quilche Forest. And to the best of my knowledge, Owen might know more, or Andy does, but I know people had tried to find out and couldn't find out for the money in the past time. Do you know the answer to that?
I think there was someone found out that it was 2 million.
2 million
a day for about 400 acres, and they're only using about 50 acres of that at the moment for the curve. That will be one of the issues, the expansion that is planned for it.
Yeah, it's a fear that they're going to expand the refinery to also make the refinery site for other for some of the rest of this stuff when stuff is coming ashore.
In relation to I'm sorry, what was your question? The political spectrum. Oh, feeling it. The political spectrum, like I was saying earlier, basically anyone that's not on the very pro-free market kind of capitalist stuff is quite sympathetic to the Shell to Sea campaign. Certainly Labour and the Greens and Sinn Féin would have passed motions at their ordeshes and the national conferences in support of Shell to Sea. In relation to Fine Gael have a very strange kind of relationship to us. Some TDs within Fine Gael would be very anti the oil and gas giveaway, particularly since the recession has really kicked in. Other people within, like for example, Enda Kenny recently came out and said that people's rights have been trampled on in Mayo in relation to this. And when he said this at a business conference, to make it even more bizarre, down in Cork recently, the Commerce Conference, and he, when pushed on it, then a journalist pushed him on it, and in the days afterwards, and he said, oh, when I was talking about that, what I meant was before Shell had come in and when Enterprise still owned it. So I meant before the guards had come down, before there were scuffles, and when everything was done through, you know, the paper means. So you have these really bizarre comments where they say one thing and then they go completely back and say the most ridiculous thing to try and take it back. So it seems to be, if we think we're going to lose votes over being very pro the current oil and gas terms, we're going to roll back in it. And they kind of seem to, they don't have a concrete one, but basically they have been useless to us, is a short and simple answer. In terms of progressing the campaign, feeling it has been useless, and they kind of seem to want to do the whole head in the sand thing.
Labour
are supportive of us. Yeah, particularly Michael D. Higgins, the chairperson of the Labour Party, has been very supportive over the years, and has been to Mayo many times. The other ones. Why is it so extreme in Ireland? I think Amanda probably answered a bit of that. There is no reason exactly why. It's just something they've never tackled, and there hasn't been the political will to tackle.
I think also, I think sadly, we're never going to get the smoking gun on the initial corruption. I think that's probably not going to happen. But, you know, unless there's I think the best chance of it happening would be a kind of a then gone on a Florida hotel balcony type scenario, you know, where you have some falling out within the kind of within the elites who are there, but that was probably true. But if somebody ends up being indicted on some other charge, perhaps, you know, maybe this kind of worms could be open, but I think it's going to be difficult to prove it. I totally get this point about, you know, when you're talking to people, they just don't believe it. Like, if I've talked to people about it, they kind of, you know, their reaction is often, you know, have you issued a press release? We're all tired issuing press releases, you know. It is the difficulty. It is so huge, both in terms of the scale of the giveaway, but also in terms of the the scale of the abuses that are happening to people on the ground. You know, so it's difficult to get that across, but it's necessary. I don't know the answer to the question on the boundary line.
I just want to go back to some of your about the actual model of terms. There isn't a set model of how natural resources are managed. And I should explain that when I introduce myself, I'm actually researching that now at the moment here in the School of Sociology. There are models that you have very much state national models, where, for example, in Norway, you have these returns from the oil and gas, but they also own the resources, and through Statoil and Hydro Norge, they look after the production and exploration of the natural resources, which is very much controlled by the state. Even though now Statoil has rolled back a bit and has opened up Statoil to the sole of shares, the state, the Norwegian state, is still the majority shareholder in the company. So there you have a state that really controls the natural resources and ensures there's decent returns back from the natural resources. So you compare that then to, you have elite royal families who then are taking massive potential, taking revenue from oil and gas and having fantastic lifestyles and not going back in the country. And then you have models such as Iran, and people have problems, some people have problems with Iran, but they have a great model in terms of the revenue from their oil and gas comes back into the country and it's used to fund infrastructure. So there's not one set model, but you do have examples of resource nationalism where countries control their natural resources. You then have examples where countries have high returns from their oil and gas production, so the actual production can be carried out by international oil companies, by oil majors, or by service providers, and trend towards countries hiring service operators to come into the works. So there's different models, there's not one set model of national. But yeah, we are extreme. So even within the last 30 years, if you look at the developments globally in terms of resource management, Ireland has went extreme in terms of the illiberal way that we totally went, we need to really make everything the best we can for oil and gas companies without really looking at the terms to own state. Okay, so we'll take a few more questions to let Maura speak, and then we'll have a brief round of questions for Maura, and then a photo of some of the researchers. Okay, so we'll talk.
Yeah, my question is just then, given the kind of guaranteed information and the legal processes that kind of destroy you, they're trying to. What tactics are left? How easy this plan out?
So Andrew, and then
Yeah, a more of a comment than a question, just on the deal, why we have internationally such a particularly bad deal. I think it actually fits into the general pattern of how the Irish state treats multinational corporations, and we've also got one of the lowest levels of corporate tax in the world. I think it's all part of that general package, you know, we're doing with oil and gas, what they've done with everything else.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I was just wondering again, like, how confident would you really be of the chances of changing the original contract at all?
Okay.
Because that's where the number of the issue is, really.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, great. So, Jeff, please, then.
In terms of the tactics, sorry, I just really like to come back to that. Somebody asked a question about who the key power players are in terms of the system. I don't think the Minister for Energy is necessarily a key power player. The Minister for Natural Resources is necessarily a particularly influential figure. I think this is more of a perhaps figurehead. Not important, culpable, but not necessarily particularly influential, or chosen not to be particularly influential. Apart from as a cover, but the real power lies elsewhere. That's partly where I even agree things to do with being, the big man of the West, as it were, and positioning himself in that regard. Tactics, there's loads of stuff to be done, I mean, at all kinds of different levels, and I think this is. You know, there's legal work to be done. There's a whole variety of different legal, whether that's defending a pre-charge of protest, or whether it's bringing judicial reviews attention against the whole process, or whether it's going to Europe on some of these issues. There's a lot of legal avenues that have yet to be explored. There's a lot of avenues for peaceful protest, and that still can be done, civil disobedience and peaceful protest. There's a lot of work still to be done, the kind of work that we and our colleagues have been doing in terms of Africa. In terms of educational work, advocacy work, meetings like this, there's a lot of avenues still to be explored. And that also ties into the confidence question. I think people, my own side, I'm as close to the campaign as obviously other people here, but confidence ebbs and flows. But when we produced that pamphlet last October, with the kind of background and current prospects, we assumed that the board had all its permission for the onshore pipeline was a done deal. We assumed it was over. At that stage, a lot of our efforts were focused on trying to get human rights monitors deployed in the area to ensure that local people weren't actually killed during the protests that would inevitably be resulted in. So, that was a victory. It was a victory primarily for the incredible dedication and ability of local people who testified against at the oral hearing, on that board of oral hearing, and whose persuasive marshalling of evidence was such that Morgan O'Hogan was left with no choice but to try and at least temporarily stymie the project. So it doesn't look very possible at the moment, maybe in some ways, to get the whole contract renegotiated, the whole deal renegotiated, but it's not impossible. Victories, for all the defeats, there have been victories, and there are still some more that can be won.
In terms of the tactics, I mean, we've always taken a very broad spectrum of tactics. Once it's on the news, it owns early blockade. We've always used an extremely broad, from legal routes to foreign knowledge, loads of different routes, loads of different tactics, and we've continued to use all the different tactics available to us. I think it's very important to say that while the local community and people who then support the local community have been, particularly the local community, have been criminalised for standing up against this project and from employing non-violent direct action. We're very open about the fact that if Shell builds something that's illegal and it doesn't have planning permission for, we will go and try and take it back down and we won't apologise for it. We do property damage and we won't say we won't. For example, last year Shell built a massive compound on a special area of conservation that was protected by EU legislation. They put massive big fences into it. They collapsed cliffs that were all protected areas for birds that are species that are nearly extinction. And they, we went down with ropes and with chains to try and drag those fences down. And we're very open about that. And despite the fact that we've been criminalised for doing those actions, it won't stop us from doing them because often they are some of the most effective ones. But we do use a very broad spectrum of actions. That will continue. The criminalisation, it should be stated very, very clearly that the criminalisation of the community really, to be honest, really only encourages people and makes people feel more and more that
if they're that annoyed at us, we must be doing something right, you know? Which would bring you to the confidence question, which, to be honest, is very confident. The GFC campaign has been going for 5 years, and still a week doesn't go by when we're not in the news, and when it's not an issue that's a thorn in the side of Shell or a thorn in the side of the government. And so for that reason, I'd be very confident. Support continues to grow, you know. Like someone had said to me 5 years ago, when I was fired from prison, or even sitting, you know, when I was getting on that bus with a hangover that morning, going down to my room, be sitting in a meeting with like 30 people, 25 people in a room, giving a talk in 5 years' time about Shell Sea. Oh, I wouldn't have believed it, but it's true, it's still here. The campaign feels like it's getting stronger, particularly in the last year, it really feels like it's getting stronger. And we really and truly, just to say before we, I guess, we pass over tomorrow, for people based in Dublin, for anyone who wants to get involved on whatever level, whether that's heavily involved or very lightly involved, would just be interested in giving a dig out, maybe for an hour or once a month. If you contact the DublinS2S.com, you'll see the details there. We meet in the city centre in a place called Shomer Spree every second Tuesday at 7 o'clock. There's contact details on the Sunday Independent leaflet, and also on the back of this, there's contacts from myself and for Gary, who's there in the corner, who's the other spokesperson for Dublin. And so if anyone wants to get involved, we're also doing a lot of leaflet distributions at the moment. Sunday Independent, we have 120,000 of them to give out. There's quite a few have gone already. But we're distributing them door to door across the whole of the county of Dublin. They're also being distributed nationally. So we are asking, I mean, even if it was a case of you could just leaflet your road and some of the few adjoining roads, that's fine as well. So we're just, basically it's open to people to get involved at whatever level they want, even if that's contacting your local TDs, whatever your particular way of getting involved is, that's fine, and it's open to people to do whatever they want. But we would ask people to get involved, and certainly to talk to other people about it, because it's very hard for us to spread the word for such a media campaign there is against us. So we would ask people to spread the word. And just one thing that's very current at the moment, Pat O'Donnell is currently serving a 7-month prison sentence. Pat O'Donnell, anyone who's been to Mayo knows the chief, as he prefers to be called. Anyone who's been to Mayo knows the chief. I know him, consider him a friend. The chief has been in prison basically for standing up and refusing to sell his rights to fish. Basically, he has a constitutional right to fish the area that Shell wanted to put the pipeline down on. They couldn't legally move him, so what they've done was repeatedly arrest him for loitering while he was fishing. And they've put him up on any public order charge that could possibly be getting against him. And he's currently serving 7 months prison sentence. So we're asking people to send, to do the postcards that Africa has, but also to write to him. He's in Castlereagh prison. His name is Pat O'Donnell. Castlereagh is in County Roscommon. So we're asking people to write letters of support, because it's something that obviously is a big deal if you're in prison and you're getting these letters in, particularly from people around the country that you haven't necessarily met before, saying they know what's happened to you and they support you. It's obviously a big boost. From 7 months, a long time, so just to say to people to put this in some letters.
This audio recording is of a Dublin Shell to Sea meeting in UCD in February 2010, just a few days after fisherman Pat O'Donnell had been jailed. You'll find more information on Dublin Shell to Sea at www.dublins2s.com. This audio was of part one of the meeting. In part two, Maura Harrington speaks and there's some more questions. The audio recording was made and edited by Andrew Flood. You'll find more audio recordings of mine at anarchism.pageabode.com.